A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corn. So I was just pulling up Google Maps there, and I was thinking about, you know, I've always wanted to do some episodes about potentially interesting travel destinations. And I was looking at kind of a chunk of the map here, and I'm looking at the following countries. Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, probably not the most best place to go, and as an Israeli, I don't think we can actually go there to begin with. Probably off the cards. Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan. And I guess this part of the world is often called, it is Central Asia, if I'm not mistaken. The landmass, in other words, that's it's between the eastern stretch of what could be called, what's called the Middle East, or the Arabian Peninsula, Iraq, Syria. Then you have Iran kind of next to Iraq, also probably geopolitically not the most recipient place for Israeli tourists currently. But just on the east coast there of the Caspian Sea and stretching east all the way to the border with China, you have this cluster of countries. So between the east of the Caspian Sea, south of Russia, border to the south by Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, that kind of cluster, that part of the world. Really interested in more about this region. It's kind of one of those places that you actually do see sometimes show up in flights out of Israel. I'm never too sure who's going there, why they're going there. Maybe there's a Jewish community or connections, but I'm looking here on the map at over Kazakhstan as I record this, and it's pretty vast, really, really big country. And it's neighboring countries. It's not somewhere that I know much about, but I'd love to get an overview of this part of the world. Historically, what has been its kind of distinguishing feature? Because I guess we tend to think of the world. There's the Far East, China, Korea, India. We think of the West as the US, South America, Africa. And I guess people kind of, I feel like people tend to forget about this kind of place in the middle there. And so I'd love to know a little bit more. If one were to plan a little tourist trail or a trip going to some of these countries, how different are they? What would you recommend? What place would you recommend checking out? And how have they fit? How do they fit in the world? Went between Europe and Asia. I feel like you always make sense out of my very incoherent prompts, and this is probably one of the more incoherent ones. I know I'm asking a lot, very, very unspecific information for a change about a very broad area. But let's talk about what a good trip through that part of the world would entail seeing and its history.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been staring at Google Maps, looking at Central Asia, and realized he knows almost nothing about it. He's talking about that stretch from the east of the Caspian Sea out to China, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Tajikistan, though he's realistic about that one. And he's asking, what actually distinguishes this region historically? How different are these countries from each other? And if you were planning a trip through there, what would you actually want to see?
Oh, this is one of those regions where the gap between what it actually is and what most people imagine is enormous. And Daniel's instinct is right. It's not just the middle between Europe and Asia, it was the middle. For about 1500 years, if you wanted to move anything valuable between China and the Mediterranean, silk, paper, gunpowder, ideas, religions, you went through here. The Silk Road wasn't one road, it was a network, and these cities were the nodes.
It's not a forgotten backwater, it's a former highway.
And the legacy of that is still visible. You go to Samarkand or Bukhara in Uzbekistan, and you're looking at architecture that was built when these were among the richest cities on earth. We're talking the 14th, 15th centuries. Timur, Tamerlane as he's often called in the West, built an empire centered on Samarkand that stretched from Delhi to Damascus. The Rajasthan Square there, with its three madrasas covered in turquoise tile, is genuinely one of the great sights of the world.
Timur wasn't exactly a gentle ruler.
No, he's a complicated figure. Estimates vary wildly, but some historians put the death toll from his campaigns in the millions. He built pyramids of skulls outside cities that resisted him. But he also patronized science, art, architecture. His grandson Ulugh Beg built an observatory in Samarkand in the 1420s that produced astronomical tables accurate enough they were still being used in Europe centuries later. He calculated the length of the year to within seconds of the modern value. That's the paradox of the region, extraordinary civilization built on often brutal conquest.
That's Uzbekistan. What about the others? Daniel mentioned Kazakhstan being vast. It is.
Kazakhstan is the ninth largest country on Earth. It's bigger than all of Western Europe combined, but most of it is steppe, grassland stretching to the horizon. Historically, it was nomadic, horse-based cultures, the Kazakh Khanate. The Russians colonized it heavily in the 19th and 20th centuries, and the Soviet period transformed it. The Virgin Lands campaign under Khrushchev turned massive areas of steppe into wheat fields, which worked for a while and then created ecological problems. And of course, the Soviets used it as a nuclear testing site, Semipalatinsk, nearly 500 tests between 1949 and 1989.
You've got Uzbekistan with the Silk Road cities, Kazakhstan with this vast steppe and Soviet legacy. What distinguishes the others?
Kyrgyzstan is the mountain one. Over 90% of the country is mountainous, the Tian Shan Range, which means celestial mountains. It's stunning. Alpine lakes peaks over 7,000 meters. Lake Issyk-Kul is the second largest alpine lake in the world after Titicaca, and it never freezes despite being at 1,600 meters elevation. It's slightly saline. The country has a strong nomadic tradition, yurt culture, eagle hunting. It's also one of the few places where you can still see genuine Silk Road caravanserais, these stone way stations where travelers and their animals would rest.
Eagle hunting is exactly what it sounds like.
Golden eagles trained to hunt foxes and hares. It's a tradition that goes back thousands of years among the Kyrgyz and Kazakh nomads. You can see demonstrations today. There's an annual festival near Lake Issyk-Kul with competitions.
That's the kind of thing Daniel would want to know about. The actual experiences that make a trip distinct, not just a checklist of monuments.
And Tajikistan is similar to Kyrgyzstan in being mountainous. The Pamir Mountains, the roof of the world. The Pamir Highway is one of the world's great road trips, though it's not for the faint of heart. It runs along the border with Afghanistan at points, through altitudes over 4,000 meters. Tajikistan is also distinct linguistically. The other Central Asian states speak Turkic languages, but Tajik is a variety of Persian. It's closer to Farsi than to Uzbek or Kazakh.
You've got this linguistic divide running through the region. Turkic north, Persian south.
That goes back to the Samanid Empire in the 9th and 10th centuries, which was a Persian state centered on Bukhara. It was a golden age for Persian literature and science. The poet Rudaki, the philosopher Avicenna, Ibn Sina, they came out of that milieu. So when people think of Persian culture as just Iran, they're missing a big piece.
Then there's Turkmenistan, which might be the strangest of the bunch.
Turkmenistan is bizarre. It's the most closed, autocratic, and surreal of the Central Asian states. The first president after independence, Saparmurat Niyazov, declared himself Turkmenbashi, leader of the Turkmen, and built a cult of personality that makes North Korea look restrained. He renamed the months after himself and his mother. He built a giant golden statue of himself in Ashgabat that rotated to face the sun. He banned ballet and opera, closed all rural hospitals, and wrote a book called the Runama, a spiritual guide. That became mandatory reading for everything from getting a driver's license to university entrance exams.
The current government...
His successor, Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedow, dialed some of it back, but not much. He's known for his bizarre hobbies. There are videos of him rapping, doing donuts in rally cars, weightlifting. His son Serdar is now president. The country sits on enormous natural gas reserves, the fourth largest in the world, but the wealth doesn't reach most people. Ashgabat, the capital, has more white marble buildings than any city on Earth. It's in the Guinness Book of Records, but it's also eerily empty. They built all these monumental structures and nobody's there.
It's like a Potemkin capital.
And getting in as a tourist is difficult. You typically need a guided tour, and independent travel is heavily restricted. but it's also home to one of the most surreal sights on Earth, the Darvaza gas crater known as the Door to Hell. It's a natural gas field that collapsed in 1971, and Soviet geologists set it on fire, expecting it to burn off in a few weeks. It's still burning, over 50 years later. In the desert at night, it's this flaming pit 70 meters across.
You've got Turkmenistan's isolation and gas crater, Uzbekistan's Silk Road cities, Kazakhstan's vast steppe, Kyrgyzstan's mountains and eagle hunters, Tajikistan's Pamir Highway. That's quite a menu. Now Daniel also mentioned something practical. He's Israeli, and he wondered about the travel situation.
This is actually one of the bright spots. Israeli passport holders have visa-free access to Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan. Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan both introduced visa-free regimes for Israelis several years ago, and they've maintained it. Kyrgyzstan has been visa-free for Israelis for a while. Tajikistan introduced an e-visa system that's straightforward. Turkmenistan is the exception. You need a visa and usually a letter of invitation, and it's the hardest to get into.
Afghanistan, as Daniel noted, is off the cards.
For obvious reasons. An Israeli passport in Afghanistan is not a good idea. But the other five are accessible. There are direct flights from Tel Aviv to Tashkent on Uzbekistan Airways, and connecting flights through Istanbul or Dubai to most of the capitals.
Practically, it's doable. What about the Jewish angle? Daniel mentioned wondering if there's a Jewish community or connection.
There's a deep Jewish history in Central Asia. The Bukharan Jews are one of the oldest Jewish communities in the world, dating back at least to the Babylonian exile. Some traditions trace their arrival to the 6th century BCE. They developed their own dialect of Judeo-Tajik, their own customs, their own musical traditions. Bukhara and Samarkand had thriving Jewish quarters for centuries. At their peak in the early 20th century, there were about 50,000 Bukharan Jews in Central Asia.
Most of them left.
The big waves of immigration were in the 1970s, 80s, and then after the Soviet Union collapsed. Today, the community in Uzbekistan is maybe a few hundred, mostly elderly. But there's a large Bukharan Jewish diaspora in Israel, in Queens, New York. In Israel, there are about 100,000 Bukharan Jews and their descendants. The Bukharan Quarter in Jerusalem is a whole neighborhood. So the connection Daniel was wondering about is real and substantial.
An Israeli traveler showing up in Bukhara isn't a random tourist. There's a historical link.
You can visit the old synagogues. There's one in Bukhara that dates back to the 16th century, still functioning. The Jewish cemetery has tombstones going back centuries. It's a living connection to a diaspora that most people don't know about.
Let's talk about how they fit in the world today. Daniel asked about that. Between Europe and Asia, what's their role?
This is where it gets geopolitically fascinating. Central Asia is one of the most contested regions on Earth right now in terms of great power influence, and most Western coverage misses it because the Middle East and East Asia dominate headlines. You've got Russia, which has historically been the dominant power here since the 19th century, the near abroad, as Moscow calls it. You've got China, which is pushing the Belt and Road Initiative through here in a massive way, billions in infrastructure, pipelines, rail links. And then you've got Turkey, which has a linguistic and cultural affinity with the Turkic states and has been building influence through trade and soft power.
The United States
had a moment after 9/11 bases in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan for the Afghanistan campaign, but that's largely wound down. Washington doesn't have the same footprint. What's interesting is how the Central Asian states manage this. They're masters of multi-vector foreign policy. Kazakhstan, for instance, has good relations with Russia, China, the West, and Israel simultaneously. It's not picking sides, it's balancing.
Which makes sense for landlocked countries surrounded by great powers.
And the economic dimension is significant. After Russia invaded Ukraine, Central Asia became a key node for sanctions evasion, goods flowing through Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan into Russia. But it's also become a destination for Russians fleeing mobilization. Bishkek, the capital of Kyrgyzstan, has seen a huge influx of Russian tech workers and entrepreneurs. It's reshaping the city.
It's not static. The region is being reshaped by the war in real time.
Kazakhstan in particular has been interesting. It's tried to maintain neutrality while also signaling it won't help Russia circumvent sanctions in obvious ways. President Tokayev has been walking a very careful line. He's also been pursuing reforms domestically. After the unrest in January 2022, he moved to reduce the power of the Nazarbayev family, who had ruled since independence. It's still authoritarian, but there's been a shift.
If Daniel were planning a trip, say 2 or 3 weeks, what would you actually recommend?
I'd start in Uzbekistan, because it's the easiest entry point and has the highest concentration of historical sites. Fly into Tashkent, spend a day or two there. It's a Soviet-planned city, but with a fascinating old town, the Korsu Bazaar, some excellent museums. Then take the high-speed train to Samarkand. The Afrosayob train does it in just over 2 hours. Samarkand deserves at least 2 full days. The Registan, the Shah-i Zinda Necropolis, the Bibi Khanim Mosque, the Ulu Beg Observatory. Then on to Bukhara, which is more intimate. The old city is a UNESCO site, and you can walk through covered bazaars that have been operating for 500 years. Kiva is further west, near the Turkmen border. It's an entire walled city, the Ichin Kala, that's basically an open-air museum. It's more remote, but worth it if you have the time. That's a solid week in Uzbekistan alone. From Uzbekistan, you could cross into Tajikistan for the Pamir Highway if you're adventurous and have time, but that's a whole trip in itself, at least a week. For a shorter trip, I'd head to Kyrgyzstan. Fly from Tashkent to Bishkek, then go to Lake Issyk-Kul. The south shore is less developed, more dramatic. You can stay in yurt camps, hike in the mountains, see eagle hunting demonstrations. Kyrgyzstan is the most accessible for outdoor adventure. It's developed a decent backpacker infrastructure. If you have time, Almaty is worth it. It's a surprisingly cosmopolitan city. Great food, coffee culture, surrounded by mountains. You can take a cable car up to Shimbulak Ski Resort, hike in the Il Alatau National Park. The big Almaty Lake is this stunning turquoise alpine reservoir. And Almaty has a fascinating history. It was the capital until 1997, and you can still feel the layers. The Russian imperial period, the Soviet era, and now this glossy, oil-funded modernity.
You mentioned oil. Kazakhstan is resource-rich.
Oil, gas, uranium. Kazakhstan is the world's largest uranium producer. The Tengiz and Kashagan oil fields are among the largest discoveries of the past 50 years. That wealth has transformed Astana, now called Nur Sultan, though I think they may have switched back to Astana, actually, the capital since 1997. It's a showcase of Starkitect buildings in the middle of the steppe. Norman Foster designed the Palace of Peace and Reconciliation, a giant glass pyramid. It's surreal, this futuristic city in the middle of nowhere built on oil money.
The contrast is striking. Ancient Silk Road cities in Uzbekistan, nomadic traditions in Kyrgyzstan, Soviet legacy and oil-fueled modernity in Kazakhstan, the Pamir wilderness in Tajikistan, and then Turkmenistan's totalitarian surrealism.
They're not interchangeable. That's the key thing. From the outside, people lump them together as the stands, but the differences are as stark as between, say, Italy and Norway. Different languages, different histories, different landscapes, different political systems. Uzbekistan has been opening up significantly under the current president, Shavkat Mirziyoyev, visa liberalization, economic reforms, a cautious political thaw. Kyrgyzstan is the most democratic of the bunch, though it's had 3 revolutions since independence and its politics are turbulent. Tajikistan is more repressive, with the Rahman family dominating since 1992. Kazakhstan is authoritarian but stable and relatively prosperous. Turkmenistan is the most closed.
Israel's relations with these countries?
Generally good and in some cases quite warm. Israel and Uzbekistan have growing ties. There's agricultural technology cooperation, water management, that kind of thing. Israeli drip irrigation technology is being used in Uzbek agriculture. Kazakhstan and Israel have a strong relationship. Trade is in the hundreds of millions. There's defense cooperation, and Kazakhstan has expressed interest in Israeli technology across multiple sectors. There have been direct flights from Tel Aviv to Almaty and Nur Sultan on Air Astana pre-pandemic, and those routes are being restored.
The water technology angle makes sense. Israel's expertise in arid agriculture is directly relevant to Central Asia.
It's a perfect fit. The Aral Sea disaster, which is one of the great environmental catastrophes of the 20th century, the Soviets diverted the rivers that fed it for cotton irrigation and it shrunk to about 10% of its original size, has left parts of Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan with serious water and soil salinity problems. Israeli agritech is precisely what they need.
There's a practical dimension to the relationship beyond tourism.
There's the energy angle. Kazakhstan is a major oil producer, and Israel has been interested in diversifying its energy sources. There was talk years ago of a pipeline from Kazakhstan through Turkey to Israel, though that never materialized. But the strategic logic is there.
Let's go back to the travel recommendations. You've laid out Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, maybe Kazakhstan. What about the practicalities? Safety, infrastructure, language?
All five countries are generally safe for travelers. Petty crime exists, but violent crime against tourists is rare. Uzbekistan has the best tourism infrastructure, good hotels, the high-speed train. English is increasingly common in the tourism sector. Kyrgyzstan is more rough and ready, but has a well-established network of guest houses and community-based tourism. Kazakhstan's cities are modern and easy to navigate. Tajikistan is more challenging. The Pamir Highway requires preparation, a 4x4, and some tolerance for discomfort. Turkmenistan is the most difficult logistically.
Language? Russian versus local languages?
Russian is the lingua franca across the region. In the cities, most people speak Russian. The local languages, Uzbek, Kazakh, Kyrgyz, Tajik, Turkmen, are the official state languages, and there's been a push to promote them since independence. But Russian remains essential for getting around. English is growing among young people in the cities, but don't expect widespread fluency outside tourist zones.
Learning a few phrases of Russian would go a long way.
And people appreciate the effort. Central Asian hospitality is legendary. The tradition of welcoming travelers is deeply ingrained, going back to the Silk Road. If you're invited into someone's home, you'll be fed. Plov, the rice dish with meat and carrots, is the national dish of Uzbekistan, and variations exist everywhere. Kumis, fermented mare's milk, is traditional in Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan. It's an acquired taste.
Have you tried it?
I wouldn't call it pleasant, but it's memorable.
That's a diplomatic answer.
It's the kind of thing where you're glad you tried it once.
If you had to pick one country for a first-time visitor to the region, it's Uzbekistan.
It's the most accessible, the richest historically, and the most developed for tourism. Samarkand alone is worth the trip. The Registan at sunset, when the tiles glow, it's one of those places that lives up to the photographs. And Bukhara, the Kalon Minaret. When Genghis Khan sacked the city in 1220, he reportedly spared the minaret because it impressed him. It's been standing for nearly 900 years.
Genghis Khan's sparing architecture is not the reputation he usually has.
The Mongol conquest of Central Asia was devastating. Cities like Merv in modern Turkmenistan were essentially erased. Contemporary accounts claim over 1 million killed, though the numbers are debated. But the region recovered. The Timurid Renaissance, a century and a half later, built on the ruins and created something new. That's a theme of Central Asian history, destruction followed by renewal. The Silk Road declined when maritime trade took over in the 16th century, and the region became a backwater for centuries. Then the Russian conquest, the Soviet period, independence in 1991, and now this new chapter.
The Soviet period, that's a whole layer of the trip. You can still see it everywhere.
The architecture, the city planning, the statues. Some countries have been more aggressive about desovietizing than others. Uzbekistan has removed most Lenin statues. Tajikistan renamed Lenin Peak, one of the highest in the Pamirs, to its original name. But the Soviet imprint is deep. The borders themselves are Soviet creations. Stalin drew the lines in the 1920s in a classic divide-and-rule strategy. The Fergana Valley, the most fertile and populous part of the region, was split between Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan in a way that guaranteed ethnic tension. Those borders are still a source of conflict today. There were serious clashes between Kyrgyz and Tajik forces in 2021 and 2022 over border disputes.
The neat lines on the map are anything but neat on the ground.
The Fergana Valley is fascinating. It's the agricultural heartland, densely populated, and it contains some of the oldest cities in the region. Kokand was the capital of an independent khanate in the 19th century. Marjalan has been a silk-producing center for 1,000 years. You can visit workshops where they still make silk by hand using traditional methods. It's less visited than Samarkand and Bukhara, but it's a different perspective on Uzbekistan.
If Daniel had 3 weeks, you'd suggest something like Tashkent, Samarkand, Bukhara, maybe Kiva, then fly to Bishkek, Lake Isik, Kyul, maybe Almaty.
That's a solid itinerary. If he's feeling ambitious, add the Pamir Highway, but that's a separate trip, really. And Turkmenistan is a separate trip, too, for the door to hell and the sheer strangeness of Ashgabat. You'd need to arrange it well in advance.
What's the best time of year?
Spring, April, May, and autumn. September, October are ideal. The summers are brutally hot in Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, 40 degrees Celsius plus. The winters are cold, especially in the mountains. May and September give you pleasant temperatures and clear skies.
Daniel's recording this now, in early May, so right in the sweet spot.
If he wanted to go this month, he'd have great weather.
Let's talk about something you mentioned earlier, the Belt and Road Initiative. How visible is that for a traveler?
Very visible in Kazakhstan especially. The Korgos Gateway on the China-Kazakhstan border is one of the largest dry ports in the world. A massive logistics hub where Chinese freight trains on China's standard gauge transfer containers to Kazakh trains on Russian broad gauge. It's not a tourist destination, but it's emblematic of how the region is being reshaped. The old Silk Road was about caravans of camels. The new Silk Road is about container trains moving between Chongqing and Duisburg in 12 days instead of weeks by sea.
That's actually functioning? It's not just a slogan?
It's real. The China-Europe rail freight network moved nearly 1.5 million TEUs, 20-foot equivalent units, in 2023. That's a fraction of maritime shipping, but it's growing, and it's transformed the logistics landscape. Central Asia is no longer a dead end. It's a corridor.
Which brings us back to Daniel's question about how the region fits between Europe and Asia. It's not just geographically between them. It's becoming a conduit again.
That's the historical resonance. For centuries, Central Asia was the middleman of the world economy. Then it got bypassed. Now it's re-emerging in that role, but in a very different form: pipelines, rail lines, fiber optic cables. The digital Silk Road is a thing. Chinese tech companies building data centers and telecom infrastructure across the region.
There's also the security dimension. Afghanistan is right there.
That's a constant concern for the Central Asian states. They share borders with Afghanistan. Tajikistan has a long and porous border, Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan shorter ones. The Taliban takeover in 2021 sent shockwaves through the region. There's been a mix of engagement and caution. Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan have been pragmatic, keeping channels open. Tajikistan has been more hostile to the Taliban, partly because of ethnic tensions. There's a large Tajik population in northern Afghanistan.
The Islamic State affiliate in Khorasan, ISIS-K, has been active.
Yes, and that's a threat all the Central Asian governments take very seriously. There was an attack on the Tajik border post in 2023. The security services across the region are deeply concerned about radicalization and cross-border militancy. It's one reason the governments maintain tight control. They see political Islam as an existential threat, and they use that to justify authoritarian measures.
The stability that makes tourism possible is partly a function of fairly repressive states.
That tension is real. Uzbekistan has opened up considerably, political prisoners released, some media freedom, but it's still not a democracy. Kazakhstan had that burst of reform after the 2022 unrest, but it's still dominated by a narrow elite. Kyrgyzstan is the most pluralistic, but it's also the most unstable. There's no easy model here.
Which is worth keeping in mind as a traveler. You're not going to Disneyland.
But that's also what makes it interesting. These are countries navigating a complex position. Landlocked, surrounded by great powers, dealing with colonial legacies, Soviet legacies, resource wealth in some cases, and resource scarcity in others, trying to build national identities after 70 years of Soviet rule that both modernized and repressed. It's a region in transition, and you can see it happening in real time.
One thing we haven't touched on is food. You mentioned plov.
Plov is central, literally and figuratively. Every Uzbek man is expected to know how to make it. There are regional variations. Samarkand plov is different from Tashkent plov, which is different from Bukharan plov. The basic components are rice, meat, carrots, onions, and spices, but the proportions and techniques vary. In Tashkent, they layer it. In Samarkand, the meat is fried separately. It's a serious culinary art form. Lagman, hand-pulled noodles with meat and vegetables, influenced by Chinese cuisine but distinct. Manti, steamed dumplings filled with meat or pumpkin. Samsa, baked pastries with meat or vegetables sold everywhere from street stalls. Shashlik, grilled meat skewers. The food is hearty, meat-heavy, designed for a climate with cold winters. In Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, beshbarmak, boiled meat with noodles, traditionally eaten with your hands, the name literally means five fingers. In Tajikistan, kurutob, a dish of bread soaked in a yogurt sauce with vegetables. It's not a cuisine that's well-known internationally, but it's distinctive and worth exploring.
For Daniel, keeping kosher would be a challenge.
There are no kosher restaurants in the region outside of maybe the Jewish community centers in Tashkent or Bukhara if they still operate. But vegetarian options exist, and fish is available in some areas. Issyk Kul has trout. It's manageable with planning, and the Bukharan Jewish culinary tradition is its own thing. There are dishes like baksha, a rice dish with cilantro and meat that are specific to that community. In Israel, you can find Bukharan Jewish restaurants. In Central Asia itself, it's mostly a memory.
Which is poignant. The cuisine survived the diaspora more than it survived in its homeland.
That's true of a lot of Jewish culinary traditions. The community that stayed dwindled, the community that left carried the food with them.
Let's circle back to Daniel's framing. He said he feels like people forget about this place. Is that fair?
I think so. Central Asia gets less attention than it deserves. It's not a conflict zone that dominates headlines, it's not an economic powerhouse, it's not a cultural exporter in the way that, say, Korea or Japan are. But it's historically one of the most significant regions on Earth, and it's geopolitically crucial today. The fact that most people couldn't name the capital of Kyrgyzstan, it's Bishkek, by the way, says something about the gaps in how we think about the world.
The capitals are worth knowing. Tashkent, Samarkand isn't the capital of Uzbekistan, even though it's more famous. Tashkent is. Astana for Kazakhstan, though that's been renamed back and forth. Bishkek for Kyrgyzstan. Dushanbe for Tajikistan. Ashgabat for Turkmenistan.
Dushanbe means Monday in Tajik. It grew out of a market town that held its bazaar on Mondays.
That's wonderfully prosaic for a national capital.
Astana literally means capital in Kazakh. They're not trying too hard.
To summarize, for Daniel, and we've covered a lot of ground, Central Asia is five distinct countries with a shared Silk Road heritage, but very different modern trajectories. Uzbekistan is the historical heart, the easiest to visit, and probably the best starting point. Kyrgyzstan is for mountains and nomadic culture. Kazakhstan is vast, modernizing, and resource-rich. Tajikistan is the Persian-speaking outlier with the Pamir Wilderness. Turkmenistan is the bizarre, isolated one with the burning gas crater. All except Afghanistan are accessible to Israeli travelers, with visa-free or easy visa arrangements. There's a deep Jewish history, particularly in Uzbekistan. And the region is geopolitically contested in ways that make it more relevant than its low profile suggests.
That's it. And I'd add, go soon. Central Asia is changing fast. The Silk Road cities are being restored but also commercialized. The Soviet layers are fading. The traditional nomadic cultures are adapting to modernity. It's still relatively undiscovered compared to, say, Southeast Asia, but that won't last forever. The Chinese tourism boom alone is transforming parts of the region.
Daniel also asked about Afghanistan. Just to close the loop there. It's not just difficult for Israelis. It's dangerous for pretty much anyone right now. The Taliban government isn't recognized internationally. The security situation is unpredictable, and the State Department and most foreign ministries advise against all travel. It's a fascinating country with an extraordinary history. The Buddhas of Bamiyan, the old city of Arat, the mountains of the Hindu Kush. But it's not a tourist destination in the current era.
That's a tragedy, because Afghanistan historically was very much part of this Central Asian world. The same Silk Road networks, the same cultural influences. It's only in the modern era that it's been cut off.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The average cumulus cloud weighs about 500,000 kilograms, roughly the same as a fully loaded jumbo jet.
When you look up at a fluffy white cloud, you're looking at a flying jumbo jet made of water droplets.
I'm going to think about that every time I see clouds now.
This has been my weird prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with someone who's planning a trip or just likes looking at maps. Find us at myweirdprompts.com.
I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll be back soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.